Contact by Carl Sagan. Read by Laurel Lefko. For Alexandra, who comes of age with the millennium, may we leave your generation a world better than the one we were given.
Part 1. The Message. My heart trembles like a poor leaf. The planets whirl in my dreams. The stars press against my window. I rotate in my sleep. My bed is a warm planet. Marvin Mercer, P.S. 153, 5th grade, Harlem, New York City, New York, 1981. Chapter 1. Transcendental Numbers. Little fly, thy summer's play, my thoughtless hand has brushed away. Am not I a fly like thee, or art not thou a man like me? For I dance and drink and sing, till some blind hand shall brush my wing. William Blake, Songs of Experience, The Fly, Stanzas 1-3, 1795. By human standards, it could not possibly have been artificial. It was the size of a world. But it was so oddly and intricately shaped, so clearly intended for some complex purpose, that it could only have been the expression of an idea. Gliding in polar orbit about the great blue-white star, it resembled some immense, imperfect polyhedron, encrusted with millions of bowl-shaped barnacles. Every bowl was aimed at a particular part of the sky. Every constellation was being attended to. The polyhedral world had been performing its enigmatic function for eons. It was very patient. It could afford to wait forever. When they pulled her out, she was not crying at all. Her tiny brow was wrinkled, and then her eyes grew wide. She looked at the bright lights, the white and green-clad figures, the woman lying on the table below her. Somehow familiar sounds washed over her. On her face was an odd expression for a newborn. Puzzlement, perhaps. When she was 2 years old, she would lift her hands over her head and say very sweetly, "Dada, up!" His friends expressed surprise. The baby was polite. "It's not politeness," her father told them. "She used to scream when she wanted to be picked up, so once I said to her, 'Ellie, you don't have to scream. Just say, Daddy, up.' Kids are smart. Right, Bresh?" So now she was up all right, at a giddy altitude, perched on her father's shoulders and clutching his thinning hair. Life was better up here, far safer than crawling through a forest of legs. Somebody could step on you down there. You could get lost. She tightened her grip. Leaving the monkeys, they turned a corner and came upon a great, spindly-legged, long-necked, dappled beast with tiny horns on its head. It towered over them. "Their necks are so long, the talk can't get out," her father said. She felt sorry for the poor creature, condemned to silence. But she also felt a joy in its existence, a delight that such wonders might be. "Go ahead, Ellie," her mother gently urged her. There was a lilt in the familiar voice. "Read it." Her mother's sister had not believed that Ellie, age 3, could read. The nursery stories the aunt was convinced had been memorized. Now they were strolling down State Street on a brisk March day, and it stopped before a store window. Inside, a burgundy-red stone was glistening in the sunlight.
"Jeweler,"
Ellie read slowly, pronouncing 3 syllables. Guiltily, she let herself into the spare room. The old Motorola radio was on the shelf where she remembered it. It was very big and heavy, and hugging it to her chest, she almost dropped it. On the back were the words, "Danger, do not remove." But she knew that if it wasn't plugged in, there was no danger in it. With her tongue between her lips, she removed the screws and exposed the innards. As she had suspected, There were no tiny orchestras and miniature announcers quietly living out their small lives in anticipation of the moment when the toggle switch would be clicked to on. Instead, there were beautiful glass tubes, a little like light bulbs. Some resembled the churches of Moscow she had seen pictured in a book. The prongs at their bases were perfectly designed for the receptacles they were fitted into. With the back off and the switch on, she plugged the set into a nearby wall socket. If she didn't touch it, if she went nowhere near it, how could it hurt her? After a few moments, tubes began to glow warmly, but no sound came. The radio was broken and had been retired some years before in favor of a more modern variety. One tube was not glowing. She unplugged the set and pried the uncooperative tube out of its receptacle. There was a metallic square inside attached to tiny wires. The electricity runs along the wires, she thought vaguely. But first it has to get into the tube. One of the prongs seemed bent, and she was able after a little work to straighten it. Reinserting the tube and plugging the set in again, she was delighted to see it begin to glow, and an ocean of static arose around her. Glancing toward the closed door with a start, she lowered the volume. She turned the dial marked frequency and came upon a voice talking excitedly. As far as she could understand, about a Russian machine that was in the sky, endlessly circling the earth. Endlessly, she thought. She turned the dial again, seeking other stations. After a while, fearful of being discovered, she unplugged the set, screwed the back on loosely, and with still more difficulty, lifted the radio and placed it back on the shelf. As she left the spare room a little out of breath, her mother came upon her and she started once more. Is everything all right, Ellie?
Yes, Mom.
She affected a casual air, but her heart was beating. Her palms were sweating. She settled down in a favorite spot in the small backyard, and her knees drawn up to her chin, thought about the inside of the radio. Are all those tubes really necessary? What would happen if you removed them one at a time? Her father had once called them vacuum tubes. What was happening inside a vacuum tube? Was there really no air in there? How did the music of the orchestras and the voices of the announcers get in the radio? They liked to say, on the air. Was radio carried by the air? What happens inside the radio set when you change stations? What was frequency? Why do you have to plug it in for it to work? Could you make a kind of map showing how the electricity runs through the radio? Could you take it apart without hurting yourself? Could you put it back together again? Ellie, what have you been up to? Asked her mother, walking by with laundry for the clothesline.
Nothing, Mom. Just thinking.
In her 10th summer, she was taken on vacation to visit two cousins she detested at a cluster of cabins along a lake in the northern peninsula of Michigan. Why people who lived on a lake in Wisconsin would spend 5 hours driving all the way to a lake in Michigan was beyond her, especially to see two mean and babyish boys. Only 10 and 11. Real jerks. How could her father, so sensitive to her in other respects, want her to play day in and day out with twerps? She spent the summer avoiding them. One sultry, moonless night, after dinner, she walked down alone to the wooden pier. A motorboat had just gone by, and her uncle's rowboat, tethered to the dock, was softly bobbing in the starlit water. Apart from distant cicadas and an almost subliminal shout echoing across the lake, it was perfectly still. She looked up at the brilliant, spangled sky and found her heart racing. Without looking down, with only her outstretched hand to guide her, she found a soft patch of grass and laid herself down. The sky was blazing with stars. There were thousands of them, most twinkling, a few bright and steady. If you looked carefully, you could see faint differences in color. That bright one there, wasn't it bluish? She felt again for the ground beneath her. It was solid, steady, reassuring. Cautiously, she sat up and looked left and right, up and down the long reach of lakefront. She could see both sides of the water. The world only looks flat, she thought to herself. Really, it's round. This is all a big ball, turning in the middle of the sky once a day. She tried to imagine it spinning, with millions of people glued to it, talking different languages, wearing funny clothes, all stuck to the same ball. She stretched out again and tried to sense the spin. Maybe she could feel it just a little. Across the lake, a bright star was twinkling between the topmost branches. If you squinted your eyes, you could make rays of light dance out of it. Squint a little more, and the rays would obediently change their length and shape. Was she just imagining it, or... The star was now definitely above the trees. Just a few minutes ago, it had been poking in and out of the branches. Now it was higher, no doubt about it. That's what they meant when they said a star was rising, she told herself. The earth was turning in the other direction. At one end of the sky, the stars were rising. That way was called east. At the other end of the sky, behind her, beyond the cabins, the stars were setting. That way was called west. Once every day, the earth would spin completely around, and the same stars would rise again in the same place. But if something as big as the earth turned once a day, it had to be moving ridiculously fast. Everyone she knew must be whirling at an unbelievable speed. She thought she could now actually feel the earth turn, not just imagine it in her head, but really feel it in the pit of her stomach. It was like descending in a fast elevator. She craned her neck back further, so her field of view was uncontaminated by anything on earth, until she could see nothing but black sky and bright stars. Gratifyingly, she was overtaken by the giddy sense that she had better clutch the clumps of grass on either side of her and hold on for dear life, or else fall up into the sky, her tiny tumbling body dwarfed by the huge, darkened sphere below. She actually cried out before she managed to stifle the scream with her wrist. That was how her cousins were able to find her. Scrambling down the slope, they discovered on her face an uncommon mix of embarrassment and surprise, which they readily assimilated, eager to find some small indiscretion to carry back and offer to her parents. The book was better than the movie. For one thing, there was a lot more in it, and some of the pictures were awfully different from the movie. But in both, Pinocchio, a life-sized wooden boy who magically is roused to life, wore a kind of halter, and there seemed to be dowels in his joints. When Geppetto is just finishing the construction of Pinocchio, he turns his back on the puppet and is promptly sent flying by a well-placed kick. At that instant, the carpenter's friend arrives and asks him what he is doing sprawled on the floor. "I am teaching," Geppetto replies with dignity, "the alphabet to the ants." This seemed to Ellie extremely witty, and she delighted in recounting it to her friends. But each time she quoted it, there was an unspoken question lingering at the edge of her consciousness. Could you teach the alphabet to the ants? And would you want to? Down there with hundreds of scurrying insects who might crawl all over your skin or even sting you? What could ants know, anyway? Sometimes she would get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and find her father there in his pajama bottoms, his neck craned up, a kind of patrician disdain accompanying the shaving cream on his upper lip. "Hi, Presh," he would say. It was short for Precious, and she loved him to call her that. Why was he shaving at night when no one would know if he had a beard? "Because," he smiled, "your mother will know." Years later, she discovered that she had understood this cheerful remark only incompletely. Her parents had been in love. After school, she had ridden her bicycle to a little park on the lake. From a saddlebag, she produced The Radio Amateur's Handbook and A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. After a moment's consideration, she decided on the latter. Twain's hero had been conked on the head, and awakened in Arthurian England. Maybe it was all a dream or a delusion. But maybe it was real. Was it possible to travel backwards in time? Her chin on her knees, she scouted for a favorite passage. It was when Twain's hero is first collected by a man dressed in armor, who he takes to be an escapee from a local booby hatch. As they reach the crest of the hill, they see a city laid out before them. "Bridgeport?" said I. "Camelot," said he. She stared out into the blue lake, trying to imagine a city which could pass as both 19th-century Bridgeport and 6th-century Camelot, when her mother rushed up to her. "I've looked for you everywhere. Why aren't you where I can find you? Oh, Ellie," she whispered, "something awful's happened." In the 7th grade, they were studying Pi. It was a Greek letter that looked like the architecture at Stonehenge in England. Two vertical pillars with a crossbar at top. Pi. If you measured the circumference of a circle and then divided it by the diameter of the circle, that was pi. At home, Ellie took the top of a mayonnaise jar, wrapped a string around it, straightened the string out, and with a ruler measured the circle's circumference. She did the same with the diameter, and by long division divided the one number by the other. She got 3.21. That seemed simple enough. The next day, the teacher, Mr. Wisebrod, said that pi was about 22 over 7, about 3.1416. But actually, if you wanted to be exact, it was a decimal that went on and on forever without repeating the pattern of numbers. Forever, Ellie thought. She raised her hand. It was the beginning of the school year, and she had not asked any questions in this class.
"How could anybody know that the decimals go on and on forever?"
"That's just the way it is," said the teacher with some asperity.
"But why? How do you know? How can you count decimals forever?"
"Miss Arroway," he was consulting his class list, "this is a stupid question. You're wasting the class's time." No one had ever called Ellie stupid before, and she found herself bursting into tears. Billy Horstman, who sat next to her, gently reached out and placed his hand over hers. His father had recently been indicted for tampering with the odometers on the used cars he sold, so Billy was sensitive to public humiliation. Ellie ran out of the class, sobbing. After school, she bicycled to the library at the nearby college to look through books on mathematics. As nearly as she could figure out from what she read, her question wasn't all that stupid. According to the Bible, the ancient Hebrews had apparently thought that pi was exactly equal to 3. The Greeks and Romans, who knew lots of things about mathematics, had no idea that the digits in pi went on forever without repeating. It was a fact that had been discovered only about 250 years ago. How was she expected to know if she couldn't ask questions? But Mr. Wisebrod had been right about the first few digits. Pi wasn't 3.21. Maybe the mayonnaise lid had been a little squashed, not a perfect circle. Or maybe she'd been sloppy in measuring the string. Even if she'd been much more careful, though, they couldn't expect her to measure an infinite number of decimals. There was another possibility, though. You could calculate pi as accurately as you wanted. If you knew something called calculus, you could prove formulas for pi that would let you calculate it to as many decimals as you had time for. The book listed formulas for pi divided by 4. Some of them she couldn't understand at all. But there were some that dazzled her. Pi over 4, the book said, was the same as 1 minus 1 third plus 1 fifth minus 1 seventh plus... with the fractions continuing on forever. Quickly, she tried to work it out, adding and subtracting the fractions alternately. The sum would bounce from being bigger than pi over 4 to being smaller than pi over 4. But after a while, you could see that this series of numbers was on a beeline for the right answer. You could never get there exactly, but you could get as close as you wanted if you were very patient. It seemed to her a miracle that the shape of every circle in the world was connected with this series of fractions. How could circles know about fractions? She was determined to learn calculus. The book said something else. Pi was called a transcendental number. There was no equation with ordinary numbers in it that could give you pi unless it was infinitely long. She had already taught herself a little algebra and understood what this meant. And pi wasn't the only transcendental number. In fact, there was an infinity of transcendental numbers. More than that, there were infinitely more transcendental numbers than ordinary numbers, even though pi was the only one of them she had ever heard of. In more ways than one, pi was tied to infinity. She had caught a glimpse of something majestic. Hiding between all the ordinary numbers was an infinity of transcendental numbers whose presence you would never have guessed unless you looked deeply into mathematics. Every now and then, one of them, like pi, would pop up unexpectedly in everyday life. But most of them, an infinite number of them, she reminded herself, were hiding, minding their own business. Almost certainly unglimpsed by the irritable Mr. Wisebroad. She saw through John Stoughton from the first. How her mother could even contemplate marrying him, never mind that it was only 2 years after her father's death, was an impenetrable mystery. He was nice enough looking, and he could pretend, when he put his mind to it, that he really cared about you. But he was a martinet. He made his students come over weekends to weed and garden at the new house they had moved into, and then made fun of them after they left. He told Ellie that she was just beginning high school and was not to look twice at any of his bright young men. He was puffed up with imaginary self-importance. She was sure that as a professor he secretly despised her dead father, who had been only a shopkeeper. Stoughton had made it clear that an interest in radio and electronics was unseemly for a girl, that it would not catch her a husband, that understanding physics was for her a foolish and aberrational notion. Pretentious, he called it. She just didn't have the ability. This was an objective fact that she might as well get used to. He was telling her this for her own good. She'd thank him for it in later life. He was, after all, an associate professor of physics. He knew what it took. These homilies would always infuriate her, even though she had never before, despite Stoughton's refusal to believe it, considered a career in science. He was not a gentleman, as her father had been, and he had no idea what a sense of humor was. When anyone assumed that she was Stoughton's daughter, she would be outraged. Her mother and stepfather never suggested that she change her name to Stoughton. They knew what her response would be. Occasionally there was a little warmth in the man, as when, in her hospital room, just after her tonsillectomy, he had brought her a splendid kaleidoscope. "When are they going to do the operation?" she had asked a little sleepily.
"They've already done it," Stoughton had answered. "You're going to be fine."
She found it disquieting that whole blocks of time could be stolen without her knowledge, and blamed him. She knew at the time it was childish. That her mother could truly love him was inconceivable. She must have remarried out of loneliness, out of weakness. She needed someone to take care of her. Ellie vowed she would never accept a position of dependence. Ellie's father had died. Her mother had grown distant. And Ellie felt herself exiled to the house of a tyrant. There was no one to call her Presh anymore. She longed to escape. "Bridgeport?" said I. "Camelot," said he. Chapter 2. Coherent Light. Since I first gained the use of reason, my inclination toward learning has been so violent and strong that neither the scoldings of other people nor my own reflections have been able to stop me from following this natural impulse that God gave me. He alone must know why, and he knows too that I have begged him to take away the light of my understanding, leaving only enough for me to keep his law, for anything else is excessive in a woman, according to some people, and others say it is even harmful. Juana Inés de la Cruz. Reply to the Bishop of Puebla, 1691, who had attacked her scholarly work as inappropriate for her sex. I wish to propose for the reader's favorable consideration a doctrine which may, I fear, appear wildly paradoxical and subversive. The doctrine in question is this, that it is undesirable to believe a proposition when there is no ground whatever for supposing it true. I must, of course, admit that if such an opinion became common, it would completely transform our social life and our political system, since both are at present faultless. This must weigh against it. Bertrand Russell, Skeptical Essays 1, 1928. Surrounding the blue-white star in its equatorial plane was a vast ring of orbiting debris, rocks and ice, metals and organics, reddish at the periphery and bluish closer to the star. The world-sized polyhedron plummeted through a gap in the rings and emerged out the other side. In the ring plane, it had been intermittently shadowed by icy boulders and tumbling mountains. But now, carried along its trajectory toward a point above the opposite pole of the star, the sunlight gleamed off its millions of bowl-shaped appendages. If you looked very carefully, you might have seen one of them make a slight pointing adjustment. You would not have seen the burst of radio waves washing out from it into the depths of space. For all the tenure of humans on Earth, the night sky had been a companion and an inspiration. The stars were comforting. They seemed to demonstrate that the heavens were created for the benefit and instruction of humans. This pathetic conceit became the conventional wisdom worldwide. No culture was free of it. Some people found in the skies an aperture to the religious sensibility. Many were awestruck and humbled by the glory and scale of the cosmos. Others were stimulated to the most extravagant flights of fancy. At the very moment that humans discovered the scale of the universe and found that their most unconstrained fancies were in fact dwarfed by the true dimensions of even the Milky Way galaxy, they took steps that ensured that their descendants would be unable to see the stars at all. For a million years, humans had grown up with a personal daily knowledge of the vault of heaven. In the last few thousand years, they began building and emigrating to the cities. In the last few decades, a major fraction of the human population had abandoned a rustic way of life. As technology developed and the cities were polluted, the nights became starless. New generations grew to maturity, wholly ignorant of the sky that had transfixed their ancestors and that had stimulated the modern age of science and technology. Without even noticing, just as astronomy entered a golden age, most people cut themselves off from the sky, a cosmic isolationism that ended only with the dawn of space exploration. Ellie would look up at Venus and imagine it was a world something like the Earth, populated by plants and animals and civilizations, but each of them different from the kinds we have here. On the outskirts of town, just after sunset, she would examine the night sky and scrutinize that unflickering bright point of light. By comparison with nearby clouds just above her, still illuminated by the sun, it seemed a little yellow. She tried to imagine what was going on there. She would stand on tiptoe and stare the planet down. Sometimes she could almost convince herself that she could really see it. A swirl of yellow fog would suddenly clear, and a vast, jeweled city would briefly be revealed. Air cars sped among the crystal spires. Sometimes she would imagine peering into one of those vehicles and glimpsing one of them. Or she would imagine a young one, glancing up at a bright blue point of light in its sky, standing on tiptoe and wondering about the inhabitants of Earth. It was an irresistible notion. A sultry, tropical planet, brimming over with intelligent life, and just next door. She consented to rote memorization, but knew that it was at best the hollow shell of an education. She did the minimum work necessary to do well in her courses and pursued other matters. she arranged to spend free periods and occasional hours after school in what was called shop, a dingy and cramped small factory, established when the school devoted more effort to vocational education than was now fashionable. Vocational education meant, more than anything else, working with your hands. There were lathes, drill presses, and other machine tools, which she was forbidden to approach, because no matter how capable she might be, she was still a girl. Reluctantly, they granted her permission to pursue her own projects in the electronics area of the shop. She built radios more or less from scratch, and then went on to something more interesting. She built an encrypting machine. It was rudimentary, but it worked. It could take any English language message and transform it by a simple substitution cipher into something that looked like gibberish. Building a machine that would do the reverse, converting an encrypted message into clear when you didn't know the substitution convention, that was much harder. You could have the machine run through all the possible substitutions. A stands for B, A stands for C, A stands for D. Or you could remember that some letters in English were used more often than others. You could get some idea of the frequency of letters by looking at the sizes of the bins for each letter of type in the print shop next door. E-T-A-O-I-N. S-H-R-D-L-U, the boys in print shop would say, giving pretty closely the order of the 12 most frequently used letters in English. In decoding a long message, the letter that was most common probably stood for an E. Certain consonants tended to go together, she discovered. Vowels distributed themselves more or less at random. The most common three-letter word in the language was the. If within a word there was a letter standing between a T and an E, it was almost certainly H. If not, you could bet on R or a vowel. She deduced other rules and spent long hours counting up the frequency of letters in various school books before she discovered that such frequency tables had already been compiled and published. Her decrypting machine was only for her own enjoyment. She did not use it to convey secret messages to friends. She was unsure to whom she might safely confide these electronic and cryptographic interests. The boys became jittery or boisterous, and the girls looked at her strangely. Soldiers of the United States were fighting in a distant place called Vietnam. Every month, it seemed, more young men were being scooped off the street or the farm and packed off to Vietnam. The more she learned about the origins of the war, and the more she listened to the public pronouncements of national leaders, the more outraged she became. The president and the Congress were lying and killing, she thought to herself, and almost everyone else was mutely assenting. The fact that her stepfather embraced official positions on treaty obligations, dominoes, and naked communist aggression only strengthened her resolve. She began attending meetings and rallies at the college nearby. The people she met there seemed much brighter, friendlier, more alive than her awkward and lusterless high school companions. John Stoughton first cautioned her, and then forbade her to spend time with college students. They would not respect her, he said. They would take advantage of her. She was pretending to a sophistication she did not have and never would. Her style of dress was deteriorating. Military fatigues were inappropriate for a girl and a travesty, a hypocrisy, for someone who claimed to oppose the American intervention in Southeast Asia. Beyond pious exhortations to Ellie and Stoughton not to fight, her mother participated little in these discussions. Privately, she would plead with Ellie to obey her stepfather, to be nice. Ellie now suspected Stoughton of marrying her mother for her father's life insurance. Why else? He certainly showed no signs of loving her, and he was not predisposed to be nice. One day, in some agitation, her mother asked her to do something for all their sakes. Attend Bible class. While her father, a skeptic on revealed religions, had been alive, there was no talk of Bible class. How could her mother have married Stoughton? The question welled up in her for the thousandth time. Bible class, her mother continued, would help instill the conventional virtues, but even more important, it would show Stoughton that Ellie was willing to make some accommodation. Out of love and pity for her mother, she acquiesced. So every Sunday for most of one school year, Ellie went to a regular discussion group at a nearby church. It was one of the respectable Protestant denominations, untainted by disorderly evangelism. There were a few high school students, a number of adults, mainly middle-aged women, and the instructor, the minister's wife. Ellie had never seriously read the Bible before, and had been inclined to accept her father's perhaps ungenerous judgment that it was half barbarian history, half fairy tales. So, over the weekend preceding her first class, she read through what seemed to be the important parts of the Old Testament, trying to keep an open mind. She at once recognized that there were two different and mutually contradictory stories of creation in the first two chapters of Genesis. She did not see how there could be light and days before the sun was made, and had trouble figuring out exactly who it was that Cain had married. In the stories of Lot and his daughters, of Abraham and Sarah in Egypt, of the betrothal of Dinah, of Jacob and Esau, she found herself amazed. She understood that cowardice might occur in the real world, that sons might deceive and defraud an aged father, that a man might give craven consent to the seduction of his wife by the king, or even encourage the rape of his daughters. But in this holy book, there was not a word of protest against such outrages. Instead, it seemed the crimes were approved, even praised. When class began, she was eager for a discussion of these vexing inconsistencies, for an unburdening illumination of God's purpose, or at least for an explanation of why these crimes were not condemned by the author, or author with a capital A. But in this she was to be disappointed. The minister's wife blandly temporized. Somehow these stories never surfaced in subsequent discussion. When Ellie inquired how it was possible for the maidservants of the daughter of Pharaoh to tell just by looking that the baby in the bulrushes was Hebrew, the teacher blushed deeply and asked Ellie not to raise unseemly questions. The answer dawned on Ellie at that moment. When they came to the New Testament, Ellie's agitation increased. Matthew and Luke traced the ancestral line of Jesus back to King David. But for Matthew, there were 28 generations between David and Jesus. For Luke, 43. There were almost no names common to the two lists. How could both Matthew and Luke be the Word of God? The contradictory genealogies seemed to Ellie a transparent attempt to fit the Isaianic prophecy after the event. Cooking the data, it was called in chemistry lab. She was deeply moved by the Sermon on the Mount, deeply disappointed by the admonition to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and reduced to shouts and tears after the instructor twice sidestepped her questions on the meaning of, "I bring not peace, but the sword." She told her despairing mother that she had done her best, but wild horses wouldn't drag her to another Bible class. She was lying on her bed. It was a hot summer's night. Elvis was singing, "One night with you, that's what I'm begging for." The boys at the high school seemed painfully immature, and it was difficult, especially with her stepfather's strictures and curfews, to establish much of a relationship with the young college men she met at lectures and rallies. John Stoughton was right, she reluctantly admitted to herself, at least about this. The young men, almost without exception, had a penchant for sexual exploitation. At the same time, they seemed much more emotionally vulnerable than she had expected. Perhaps the one caused the other. She had half expected not to attend college, although she was determined to leave home. Stoughton would not pay for her to go elsewhere, and her mother's meek intercessions were unavailing. But Ellie had done spectacularly well on the standardized college entrance examinations, and found, to her surprise, her teachers telling her that she was likely to be offered scholarships by well-known universities. She had guessed on a number of multiple-choice questions and considered her performance a fluke. If you know very little, only enough to exclude all but the two most likely answers, and if you then guess at 10 straight questions, there is about 1 chance in 1,000, she explained to herself, that you'll get all 10 correct. For 20 straight questions, the odds were 1 in 1,000,000. But something like 1 million kids probably took this test. Someone had to get lucky. Cambridge, Massachusetts, seemed far enough away to elude John Stoughton's influence, but close enough to return from on vacation to visit her mother, who viewed the arrangement as a difficult compromise between abandoning her daughter and incrementally irritating her husband. Ellie surprised herself by choosing Harvard over the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She arrived for orientation period, a pretty dark-haired young woman of middling height, with a lopsided smile and an eagerness to learn everything. She set out to broaden her education, to take as many courses as possible apart from her central interests in mathematics, physics, and engineering. But there was a problem with her central interests. She found it difficult to discuss physics, much less debate it, with her predominantly male classmates. At first, they paid a kind of selective inattention to her remarks. There would be a slight pause, and then they would go on as if she had not spoken. Occasionally, they would acknowledge her remark, even praise it, and then again continue undeflected. She was reasonably sure her remarks were not entirely foolish, and did not wish to be ignored, much less ignored and patronized alternately. Part of it, but only a part, she knew was due to the softness of her voice. So she developed a physics voice, a professional voice, clear, competent, and many decibels above conversational. With such a voice, it was important to be right. She had to pick her moments. It was hard to continue long in such a voice, because she was sometimes in danger of bursting out laughing. So she found herself leaning toward quick, sometimes cutting interventions, usually enough to capture their attention. Then she could go on for a while in a more usual tone of voice. Every time she found herself in a new group, she would have to fight her way through again, just to dip her oar into the discussion. The boys were uniformly unaware, even that there was a problem. Sometimes she would be engaged in a laboratory exercise or a seminar, when the instructor would say, "Gentlemen, let's proceed," and sensing Ellie's frown would add, "Sorry, Miss Arroway, but I think of you as one of the boys." The highest compliment they were capable of paying was that in their minds she was not overtly female. She had to fight against developing too combative a personality or becoming altogether a misanthrope. She suddenly caught herself. Misanthrope is someone who dislikes everybody, not just men. And they certainly had a word for someone who hates women, misogynist. But the male lexicographers had somehow neglected to coin a word for the dislike of men. They were almost entirely men themselves, she thought, and had been unable to imagine a market for such a word. More than many others, she had been encumbered with parental prescriptions. Her newfound freedoms, intellectual, social, sexual, were exhilarating. At a time when many of her contemporaries were moving towards shapeless clothing that minimized the distinctions between the sexes, she aspired to an elegance and simplicity in dress and makeup that strained her limited budget. There were more effective ways to make political statements, she thought. She cultivated a few close friends and made a number of casual enemies who disliked her for her dress, for her political and religious views, or for the vigor with which she defended her opinions. Her competence and delight in science were taken as rebukes by many otherwise capable young women. But a few looked on her as what mathematicians call an existence theorem, a demonstration that a woman could, sure enough, excel in science, or even as a role model. At the height of the sexual revolution, she experimented with gradually increasing enthusiasm, but found she was intimidating her would-be lovers. Her relationships tended to last a few months or less. The alternative seemed to be to disguise her interests and stifle her opinions, something she had resolutely refused to do in high school. The image of her mother, condemned to a resigned and placatory imprisonment haunted Ellie. She began wondering about men unconnected with the academic and scientific life. Some women, it seemed, were entirely without guile and bestowed their affections with hardly a moment's conscious thought. Others set out to implement a campaign of military thoroughness, with branched contingency trees and fallback positions, all to catch a desirable man. The word desirable was the giveaway, she thought. The poor jerk wasn't actually desired, only desirable. A plausible object of desire in the opinion of those others on whose account this whole sorry charade was performed. Most women, she thought, were somewhere in the middle, seeking to reconcile their passions with their perceived long-term advantage. Perhaps there were occasional communications between love and self-interest that escaped the notice of the conscious mind. But the whole idea of calculated entrapment made her shiver. In this matter, she decided, she was a devotee of the spontaneous. That was when she met Jesse. End of side one.